netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our guest today is Alex Fry, a longtime professional friend, but first met in the early days of FX Guide, following up with FX PhD. He's senior color and imaging engineer for ILM Sydney, but those who know him well there call him the resident color nerd. He's our guest on the podcast today to discuss the evolution and impact of ACES, the Academy Color Encoding System, focusing on the newly released ACES 2. He served as co-chair for the Output Transforms Working Group, along with Kevin Wheatley from Framestore. Now, I was actually really fortunate to hear his talk at SIGGRAPH Asia in Tokyo at the end of last year, and I really appreciate the way he clearly and concisely explained ACES and what's improved for ACES 2. I think you'll enjoy hearing from him as well, so let's go ahead and join Mike and Alex.
Alex, thanks so much for joining us, my friend. How are you?
Good, good.
So we're so keen to talk to you about ACES 2, but before we start, let's set the groundwork. So what the heck is ACES in the first place?
Sure. So ACES is an acronym that's loaded up in a couple of different ways, but fundamentally it's a color framework specifically for motion picture, color management and imaging. The sort of primary way the acronyms use is the ACES color encoding system, but there is also the ACES color space or the ACES, the Academy color encoding specification. But basically, it's a number of defined color spaces and color space transforms that come together to form a framework and a way of working that is application agnostic and is extensible and can be used for managing color in the motion picture world. And answering production questions about how things should work. Yeah, so it's a slightly nebulous thing, but fundamentally you can think of it as a way of working.
Stu Matchewich, who's a good friend and a great guy, at a panel at, I think, NAB or somewhere, said, it's like somebody's given the industry a gift of making colors work when you're moving between different devices. And it's just this thing you should use because it's a gift. And it's so marvelous that it solves these problems for you. If you bother going to the trouble of using it, it just solves problems and makes your life better, kind of was the gist of his talk. And I think that's pretty true at a high level.
Yes, that's certainly the goal of it. Once you get into the nitty gritty, it doesn't magically do anything. But what it does do is give the industry a common sort of baseline to work upon. It gives people a common language to describe those things and fundamentally a reference implementation that different implementers can match. So prior to ACES coming along, a lot of the same ideas were in circulation, but they would often be unique to the different companies that were doing this sort of stuff. So large post-production companies or large visual effects companies would often be using similar concepts and ideas as ACES, but they would all call them slightly different things or use 90% overlapping language that doesn't entirely translate. So what it did was, it was the industry coming together to try and standardize those things so we could all be having the same conversation.
So we'll get technical in a second, but in the simplest sense, it's saying, hey, I'm pulling this camera image here that's clearly got some kind of color characteristics. I'm pulling this other image over here, different color characteristics. Let's all move it to the same base language setup style thing, which of course is actually a color space. And then if we've all got it translated into that one thing, then I can cut between them and stuff. And at the end, I can output them to something else, but it's a bit like if I had a bunch, and I'm using an analogy here, of course, but if I had a bunch of different file formats and I said, hey, just convert them all to being JPEG, and then I know where I am. I just don't give me 58 different things and try and make me to mix them between them. Now, of course, that's not a good analogy because in that analogy, JPEG is a compressed, low-quality thing. ACES aspires to be top of the heap in terms of like, absolutely the gold standard for sort of professional reference color space.
Yes. And the compression and the quality thing is part of the story. But if you're thinking about it, say, in 3D terms or in mapping terms, it would be like having a different coordinate system between different 3D applications. Yeah, I mean, 3D guys know the really high level one. Yeah, which direction is up? Is it Y or is it Z? And that's simply one dimension flip. But with color spaces, they are all fundamentally 3D coordinate systems. And when you're moving between them, it's like you're changing the coordinates on your map. You know, you can have a map of Sydney and describe the same place as, you know, a GPS coordinate, or, you know, page 52, G11 of a Gregory Street directory, or, you know, a URL in Google Maps, or, you know.
Like how you've gone old school with a street directory. For those people listening to this not our age, that would be a paper map. Okay, so that's it. Like people listening to this podcast, people that know us will be like, please don't stay at this level of abstraction. Please get into the nitty gritty, because that's why we want to hear. So let's dive down another layer. If Aces 2 has just been released, what the hell was wrong with Aces 1?
So the big sort of headline feature of Aces 2 is a new set of display transforms. So the Aces system, if you imagine the block diagram in your head, you've got some input, whether it's a particular camera or a CG render or a texture or something on one end, and you want to transform it into Aces. You're going through what's called an input device transform. You get into Aces, you do some stuff there, and then you've got to take those numbers that are sitting in the abstract in a non-displayable color space and get them onto something that you can actually look at, whether it's a standard dynamic range computer monitor or a high dynamic range video monitor or a digital projector. You can't just look at the data. You've got to go through a transformation of some sort to prepare it for some actual screen that you can, cast your eyes at. Now, the display transforms that shipped with the Aces 1 system worked pretty well, and worked very well given the technology that we the sort of larger community had at the time, 15, verging on 20 years ago for some of the early development for that sort of stuff. It did a very good job, but there are a bunch of real world sort of artifacts and production problems that have become more evident as more capable screens have become possible. Yeah, so high dynamic range screens, there were sort of theoretical ideas about how they would behave, but in practice, things just people have got used to actually working with them. And cameras as well have produced images that are sort of harder to deal with. So the weak spots of the original Aces RT and ODT system were really focused around very saturated or very bright colors, or worst case, both of those things at the same time. Through the original transforms, you would get imagery that, could collapse in certain ways and also be inconsistent between HDR and SDR. So the Aces 2 transforms are a rethinking of how we get from these abstract values that are in your sort of Aces working space to different display devices in a way that is creatively consistent, but also takes advantage of the capabilities of different Apple devices.
So why isn't that just a 3D LUT?
You can certainly implement it as a 3D LUT. Many things will implement it as a 3D LUT, but it is, what does that LUT do? When someone gives you a 3D LUT, something made it. It could be something that was sampled off another, display medium, something that's sampled off a film print. It could be something that's just been wrangled together in a DI suite by someone spinning the balls. Or it could be something that is sort of very intentionally designed and principled. And that's, what our system intends to do.
Yeah, because this isn't, it looks good, hence it is good. This is a process that gives you a known space to be in and a known space out. So to that end, tell me what scene referred and display referred is, because those are two key concepts.
Yeah, that was certainly a key concept that, when it finally clicked in my head, made me understand a whole bunch of color management stuff much more clearly. So scene referred means that you are describing the intensities and the color values of things that are in your scene, things that are on the far side of the camera. So you're trying to capture and represent values as they would exist in the real world. And you can describe those, everyone sort of hears log, linear, gamma encoded, tossed around, Rec 709 primaries, P3 primaries. Separate from that, that's sort of the encoding that you're using. What are you actually describing? So if you're describing a scene referred value, you're describing the thing that is on the far side of the camera, the thing that is in the scene. Whereas display referred imagery or display referred colors, you are describing the light that is emitting from the screen. So you're describing a particular colorimetric coordinates and a particular intensity that is coming out of the screen, flying through the air and entering your eyeballs. Now, the reason that we need these sort of fairly complicated transformations to go from a scene referred space to a display referred space is that display referred spaces are far more constrained than the real world. If you talk about a regular Rec 709 screen, it's got a finite gamut. It can't go any brighter than 100 nits. You've just got this tiny little kind of bubble that all of the colors need to exist in. Whereas if you walk out into the real world, all colors that are perceivable by humans can exist out there, and incredibly wide ranging intensities going from, if you're out in a dark field on a night with barely any moonlight versus to blazing midday sun, the difference in intensity there is gigantic. All of those are possible within a scene referred space, but only a tiny, tiny subset of that is possible within a display referred space. So you've got questions of exposure, but if nothing else, you just have to compress this broad range of contrast and broad range of potential colors down to what the display can actually give you.
Right, which gets us DRT.
Yes. Yeah. So DRT is an acronym for Display Rendering Transform. In ACES 1, that was sort of separated into two components. There's the RRT, or the Reference Rendering Transform, which you could think of as sort of a virtual film stock that had some aesthetic tweaks rolled into it. And there was the ODT, which was very much a final technical transform that rolled off the top end to the finite amount of dynamic range that the display would have, and also cut it down to whatever the specific gamut of the display was, and then applied the inverse EOTF. So you could, whether it was a gamma 2.4 screen or a piecewise sRGB screen or PQ encoded screen, whatever it was, it would do that final encoding. In our system, in the ACES 2 system, the two are much more intrinsically linked. So it's become a single rendering transform. So there isn't that same conceptual separation that there used to be, but functionally for people in an application, it works the same way. You would never, in ACES 1 applications, deal with the RRT and the ODT independently of each other. They're always sort of presented as one single transformation. But now they are just a single blob of code. It all happens at the same time.
Okay, so in that this has been published and that there's this whole new version, what's OpenColor and how does that relate to ACES?
So OpenColor.io is a color implementation framework. So you can use the ACES workflow within OpenColor.io, and a lot of applications use OpenColor.io to implement the ACES system. It's not intrinsically linked to it, though. You can implement other color management workflows and other color management systems within OpenColor.io. It just happens to be by far the most common way you'll be exposed to ACES, because applications like Nuke and Houdini and I believe a number of the Autodesk applications will all use OpenColor.io as the implementation mechanism. But it is sort of separate and independent from a certain point of view. So you can implement ACES within other applications like DaVinci Resolve or in Baselight, which use fundamentally different underlying mechanisms to implement it, but they're still implementing the ACES system.
So in a sense, it's most likely that I would come across it if I was an artist, because that's an open source standard and everybody sort of supports it. So it's a good way for an equipment manufacturer, whatever, to be able to give me, in my particular app, access to ACES. Would that be a fair way of characterizing?
Yeah, exactly. And it gives you know, larger facilities, a lot of flexibility in terms of the exact way that they implement it. You know, you can just use the standard off-the-shelf Academy ASUS config, or you can modify it, or you can implement it in a slightly different way. You know, different production houses often have historical reasons why they may want to use ASUS, but use it with a, you know, one or two modifications that make sense for them for various, you know, proprietary reasons.
So I've got this system and it's set up. Let's talk about what I might see or with a client be trying to battle. To that end, what's the Notorious Six?
Right. So with the original ASUS RT and ODT combination, all of the tone mapping was done as 1D curves in an RGB rendering space, specifically AP1 with divisions towards the end. When you apply a tone scale in an RGB color space, things have a tendency to skew towards the secondaries. So we get two types of hue skewing. You get some clipping-based ones that tend to skew towards the primaries, and then you get some other ones that are to do with the application of the tone scale that skew things towards the secondaries. So if you take a hue sweep across the entire range and then expose it up, particularly if they're extreme, say, AP1 values in this entire hue sweep, you will very quickly, as exposure increases, see a certain amount of collapse towards the primaries, but then a much stronger collapse towards the secondaries. So, you know, if you have an absolutely blue, it will stay blue. But if it deviates a tiny bit, it will very quickly skew towards cyan, or potentially magenta, depending on which side of the barrier it's on. Separately from the ASUS system, you can see this very easily with a lot of broadcast stuff. It happens at a more extreme place with the ASUS stuff, but if anyone watches Formula One, all of the onboards, you will very quickly see the sky in all of their onboard cameras just skew towards cyan. That very clearly shows it there. And another place you'll see it is on any wet race. If you look at the red tail lights when there's spray going around, you'll get this strange effect where you'll probably get a yellow skewed clip in the middle of the light, where what is a red light has skewed towards yellow. But you'll also get a collapse around that, where even though it's a bright red flare, the values will actually be darker because they'll be a dark red. And then it will eventually transition off to a much brighter white value as the color desaturates in the spray. So you get this very strange thing where the core of it is completely the wrong color. And then you get a brightness error all around that where the color has collapsed towards the red primary. And basically it doesn't look at all like it should. You know, the core of the light should be the brightest thing. The light that's spreading around it should be less bright, but still proportionally brighter than everything else. And then where the light's fallen off should be the darkest thing. So that's always a really clear place to see it, or other similar properties where you have, you know, a bright intense light that's then filtering out. You can sometimes see it with blue lights that have been shot on set, where you can have someone who looks fairly normal and then you'll hit them with a very narrow band blue emitter, and then they'll actually get darker because they're getting hit by this blue light. And that should never happen. You know, light's always additive. If you throw more light at something, there's more energy there. It should be brighter. But you can get these strange collapses or skews very easily with real photography. And it's not in the data. If you look at the underlying data that's come off the camera, there is an increase in intensity there. It's a byproduct of the way that scene linear data is being transformed to the display.
And that's something that I think illustrates the whole point really well, which is to say, if I was sitting there and I was making the new F1 movie or whatever, and I had some footage that was like this, this is not a problem to be solved in the grade, because this is not a problem where you say, oh, look, you know, maybe I want to adjust the black levels or something, because what you're describing is a kind of inherently funky, weird change across a spectrum of intensity values in a way I don't expect. It's not something that's well suited to grading out. It's not like, so why you want to kind of go ASUS in the first place is to kind of not have the problems that are inherently really hard to fix, because you're in a good place to start with, I guess.
Yeah, it should behave predictably and well out of the box. We had a number of sort of design goals with the Aces 2 display transforms, some of which are sort of in tension with each other. Yeah, it's very tricky to do, and probably most of our development time was spent balancing some of these things. So it had to look good out of the box. You know, you can't have something that is just unattractive to look at. You know, there are some sort of very simple but very naive display transforms you can build that sort of, you can make a case that they are being very neutral, but they also look very unattractive. So it's got to look good. It's also got to deal well with extreme values. So that was one of the major bits of feedback out of the original Aces project, was that the handling of narrow band emitters or other extreme images, whether it's real photography on set that's got LEDs lighting it, or whether it's extreme CG renders, we wanted to prevent a lot of the problem areas associated with those. We wanted it to be more consistent with how it rendered between SDR and HDR. So you can make a creative call in the SDR domain and also in the HDR domain and have it sort of be meaningful across the two. Because with the original one, if you did certain things, you could make calls in SDR that didn't make sense in HDR. I'll come back to that bit a little bit later. It also had to be invertible. Now, that means that you can pass imagery forward through it, but also take a display referred image and then have it pass back through the transform and give you plausible scene linear values that will survive another trip forward again. We have to be able to hit the corners of the display cube for sort of normal sRGB, Rec. 709, P3 standard dynamic range images. The reason for that is that there are a lot of things that need to make their way into an Aces display pipeline that you don't want to modify that are sitting out of the extremes. The obvious example being logos. There are plenty of brand logos that really sit right out of the corners, and we can't have them come out a completely different color. So we want to be smooth, we want to be predictable, but we also want to be able to put something right in the very corner of the display. We want to be able to invert that whole display referred image and come back into our scene referred domain, but not have it end up in a crazy position. So we have a gamut compressor, but there is a interesting sort of tension there with how strong the gamut compressor works versus the working space that you need to project back into. And all of these things sort of have to work with each other all of the time. So there's many things in there that you can come up with easier answers for, but they break some of the other design goals.
Discuss a couple of other tricky things, like a bright green laser type or a sort of a iridescent or fluorescent kind of, like that's another thing that might be there on set that's going to cause you problems later otherwise if you weren't using this.
Yeah. I mean, the way narrowband with emitters cause those collapses in the corners in the older system, that was often a complaint that people would run into. It is interconnected with some of the input transform math that's going on there. So input device transforms are usually pretty tightly linked to the sort of capture spaces of the various cameras. So RE wide, both flavors of that, or particularly RE wide 3, has a blue primary that sits way off in what's called imaginary space. So it's sort of off the map. If you look at a normal CIE YXY diagram with the horseshoe, their primary position is way off in a position that no color can actually exist. Now, that's not in itself a problem, but the way the color science works.
A little bit of a problem.
It's only a problem if you end up putting data out there. Okay. So if you look at Aces AP0, it also has big imaginary primaries. So there are reasons why you sometimes want to do it. Yeah, you may want to support stuff further out towards the edge. Where it gets tricky is the matrices that they use to sort of relate their capture space to to XYZ or to YXY. They tend to optimize for normal reflective colors. So skin tones, the types of color you'd see on a Macbeth chart, stuff that fits into normal, reasonable, real world, reflective objects. If you optimize for that, though, you can very easily create errors further out where very narrow bandwidth light sources can end up beyond that horseshoe shape. So they end up well out into that imaginary space. So ARRI cameras will often produce blue values that look good through their display transforms, but don't map to a physically plausible place when you feed them into the ASUS system or other systems where you're trying to map stuff back into that real world. Red cameras also do the opposite. They tend to have the same sort of issue with red lasers, conveniently with their name, but their red primary is positioned in a way where they'll often land data out into the imaginary space on the top right of the diagram. And again, you don't see this with skin tones, but it becomes really obvious with narrow bandwidth emitters. It's why things like the ACES reference gamut compressor became very important to pull stuff back into a more plausible position, particularly for visual effects work, because if you have lasers everywhere that are off the map, they're suddenly negative values, even in wide gamut color spaces.
Not to be nasty or anything, but also there were actually some bugs in ACES 1, weren't there? And there were some actual, like, problems that were that have been fixed in ACES 2.
Without talking about knowing exactly which ones you mean, it's a bit hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say with ACES 2 because there are so many pieces in there. It can be with a particular IDT or a particular ODT. There are certain little things. The main area I worked on was the output transform. So we didn't touch anything on the input transform side. That's a whole different kettle of fish. But because the whole thing works as a system, some of the design goals were about trying to deal with data that malformed is probably putting it a bit strongly, but problematic, hard to deal with data. And that's where some of those tensions come in a little bit. So we had early versions of this transform that were extremely tolerant of very out of gamut data. We had a very tolerant gamut compressor that would allow you to put stuff all over the place and it would smoothly make it end up on screen. The catch there is if you want a display transform that inverts, if you have something that can pull data from all over the map onto screen, the catch is when you then want to go in the inverse direction, you now need a gigantic color space that you can spray that data back all over. And the reality is in modern production workflows, people either work in ACES CG or they work in ACES CCT, both which use the AP1 primaries, which are a wide gamut but smaller set of primaries. So we sort of need the thing to invert to and from AP1 because that's where...
Yeah, ACES CG has been incredibly popular, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. It's made working with ACES much easier. Steve Agland and some of the guys back at Animal put out an interesting paper years ago that sort of demonstrated some problems with light accumulation in AP0 or 4 wide gamut ACES, causing a bunch of problems in ray tracing. And that definitely contributed a huge amount to it. And also just the way color pickers work. AP0 is sort of a big space. It's slightly lopsided. And it means that unless you sort of at the DCC or application level kind of really develop new color picking UIs, it feels very uncomfortable just switching to that color space, but keeping the rest of your application stack the way it was. There are theoretical fixes for some of those. There is a world where we could potentially build color pickers that work nicely, but it would require a lot of engineering across a lot of different applications to make it feel like people are getting the results they want. There are plenty of colors that fall outside of AP1 and fall outside of ACES CG that it would be nice to maintain further through the pipeline, but the trade-offs just weren't really worth it. There's not enough for them to worry about. And the whole world of existing software tooling just behaved so much better with ACES CG that it made the transition so much smoother.
Let me just get practical for a second. How did you first get involved with ACES? Where were you and how did that come to be? What was your job when you bumped into it first?
Yeah, so I was back at Animal.
Being Animal Logic in Sydney.
Yes, yes. What is now Netflix Animation Studios, but at that time, Animal. I was working on Gatsby at the time, and I'd actually seen, it was an article on your site, I can't remember the exact context, but it mentioned this thing was being developed, and I sort of started sniffing around it and found enough of the bits of code, because they were putting stuff up on GitHub, and downloaded some of the early kind of dev configs that they had. I went, this looks pretty good when we pass some of our existing imagery through this. I got in contact with Alex Forsyth at the Academy and had a chat with him about adding some extra input transforms. So we had the Lego movie in the very early stages of production then. It was far enough along that we weren't able to switch to using AP1 as a texturing space or a rendering space. But the pipeline there used wide gamut scene referred P3 as its rendering space.
Yeah.
So I was able to make a OCIO config that meant everything else stayed as it was, but we were adopting the sort of back half of the ASUS display transforms. And right out of the gate, it just behaved a lot better with our imagery than the way we'd been doing it before that. So Legend of the Guardians, that era, we just literally used a Rec 709 EOTF. Yeah, things clipped at one.
Really?
If you wanted to roll it off, you just had to manually roll it off yourself.
Wow.
It was sort of it was basically just, if you fired up Nuke and ran it in its default mode with some renders, that's what you got. So
when I'm using ASUS now, like in a modern program, I don't have to worry about a lot of the complexity that we've been talking about, because I like select something and it goes into that space, and then I can rely on what's been done. For you, though, who are talking about it at this level, for those that are listening, are you sitting there writing code? Like, what is the way that you're, because for somebody listening to this, they're like thinking, well, that all sounds good, but I have no idea how I would change a color space. Is it like, am I doing a lot of matrix mathematics? Are you some kind of savant genius when it comes to math? Like, what, give us the Alex story on like what you're actually doing when you're experimenting and developing these pipelines in somewhere like Animal Logic.
Yeah. So with that one, we're talking about that distinction between scene referred and display referred. I'd got my head around some of the basics there. I'd become interested in, how some of this stuff worked. I'd spent a lot of time talking to Chris Swinbanks. He'd been sort of the color czar there for a long time. And
very bright guy.
Yeah. And we would just spend, it's like a big company, suddenly you find the other one guy who cares about that one esoteric thing that you're interested in, and you spend your afternoons talking about esoteric white point differences or color primary issues or things like that. So for that one, I was really just modifying one of the standards Academy development configs. This is sort of back in the ASUS 0.1.1 days. So this is years before the first initial 1.0 release. But with Alex Forsyth's help from the Academy, I sort of bolted in some accommodations for Animal's working space, demonstrated it to Animal how this was going to work without upsetting any other part of the pipeline. Yeah, so it was fairly simple. It was like, it's going to look better and nothing else really has to change. So that solved
just
it.
Being, so just zero in on that for a second, how easy a sell was it in those days to be talking about this? Was it like people's eyes glossed over, or was it more like, oh my God, finally, this is something that I'd be desperately wanting to solve?
Like every presentation, if you just try and talk about it, you'll bamboozle people and they'll glaze over pretty quickly and, oh, this all sounds a bit difficult and a bit pointless. But I had the thing to a point where I had a nice, big, long, clear document, and I had a PowerPoint or a keynote deck where I had a bunch of renders side by side, one set using the existing display pipeline that we had, one using ASUS, and then we just ramp up and down through exposures, which makes it very easy to demonstrate the pros and cons. After we finished the production, I did a SIGGRAPH talk where I had literally the exact same slides I'd used to pitch to the company that we should do this. I want to say this is 2012.
Okay.
Maybe. The SIGGRAPH presentation was 2015, but me pitching this would have been 2012, I think. Yeah.
So running the clock forward to ASUS 2, what's your involvement been with that? And where are you now?
So when I was still at Animal, the Academy reached out and said, would you be interested in co-chairing this virtual working group to develop some new transforms, to develop the next generation of these transforms? Because I'd sort of become known in the ACES community on forums and places like that as someone who had opinions on this stuff. And so Kevin Wheatley from Framestore and I both sort of co-chaired it. And then we had a number of other people who contributed a lot along the way, like Nick Shaw from Antler Posts, Pekka Raikkonen, Scott Dye from the Academy, Daniele from Film Lights, and Jed Smith. There's a number of people who sort of made big contributions, plus a lot of people who sort of came and went through the whole project, which went on for years. So what that meant was we would have a call every week where we try and figure out what we're going to change. So we would sit down and sort of look at, okay, what are we actually trying to fix here? Is this a number of parameter changes to the existing transforms? Is this a fundamental reimagining? Yeah, we had periods where we were talking about, oh, do we actually need to re-architect the entire system? Yeah, how much of this do we need to change to get the outcomes that we want here? There were points where we were going, okay, do we need to be able to swap out the display transforms? Because can this one transform be all things to all people? Do we need to re-architect what does ACES actually mean? And we, at a certain point, we sort of went, okay, let's calm down a little bit here. We're just going to create a bolt-in replacement for this particular block in the block diagram. From that point on, the actual mechanics of it were, for most of us, sitting down in Nuke and just building node networks that do the transformation. So there'll be matrix modifiers in there to move from one color space to another. It might be, a bunch of color lookup up nodes. I'd sort of had some experience with that, because one of the ways I really got to know the original RRT was building a version of it just out of raw Nuke nodes and expression nodes. So that gave me a much clearer understanding, because I'd looked at it in the past and it was just this, multi-page CTL document. And you just sort of had to take it on faith that, okay, colors go in this thing at one end and they come out the other end. And I'm not entirely sure what's happened in the middle, but building it line by line out of Nuke nodes made it much clearer how the whole thing actually worked to me. So when it came time to going at it again, it was natural to start there. Some of the other guys would work directly in Python, but for me and a bunch of the other guys, it just made sense to do it in Nuke because the tooling is in there.
So when is that? When did you start doing that? When did that sort of...
So this would have been, I want to say, late 2020. So I got asked to do it while I was still at Animal. And then when I moved to ILM in late 2020 to come and do Stagecraft stuff, Jay Schulte, who's my boss, the head of color and imaging over in San Francisco, he was very supportive of, doing this as part of ILM's, ASWF open source contribution. So my time sort of counted as part of that. And we've done other things as well. Mark Bora makes a lot of contributions to OpenColor.io. Matthias Schaffenberg had done a lot of stuff for the reference gamut compressor, the RGC, part of the ACES system. So we were sort of used to doing this sort of stuff. We thought we'd probably be in and out in about a year. It ended up turning into, a 4-year project to get the output transforms done. But it just, the more we got into it, it just is a very complicated problem.
I have to say, I'm kind of intrigued this idea of just doing all this stuff in Nuke. It seems like a fun way that I would actually think of doing something. But like, did you stay doing stuff with Nuke? Or, I mean, that's perfectly valid, but...
Yeah, no, the very initial explorations just get built out of raw Nuke nodes and, the basics. At a certain point, you transition into expression nodes where you need to start describing stuff in more code-like mathematical terms. And then at a certain point, you hit a level of complexity where moving to BlinkScript is sort of the only way forward, where you need loops and more complicated lookups.
If somebody doesn't know what that is, do you want to explain what that is?
Sure, yeah. So Blink is a Nuke-specific C-like programming language. So its main sort of utility there is that it behaves the same on the GPU and on the CPU, and you're effectively writing a shader in Nuke. So with lookups and loops and sort of certain programmatic concepts that are very hard to represent as node graphs, it really shines. So yeah, we're doing a lot of iteration and a lot of abstraction, I guess you'd say. And also if you're trying to use things that have been defined as code. So the color appearance model that we're using, Helwig 2022, you know, that's defined as either C or Visa Python implementation as well. If you're trying to represent something like that, it's a lot easier to work in a coding language like Blink Script.
Well, I wouldn't say it's necessarily easier. I think it's more precise.
Yeah.
It's less visual, but more precise. But I mean, for some people, it's easier, I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I once had a discussion with a colleague over color space, and I was asking this complicated question. He said, I can explain this to you easy. I'll just send you an email. And he sent me the code, like literally the code. It was from Flame, right? And I remember thinking at the time, for him, that was the easiest way to explain it because I could actually see for myself what was going on because it was as clear as day, right? It was just written out all in code. Of course, not being a very good programmer, it didn't actually help me that much. But from him, for his perspective, it was the clearest way possible to let me know exactly what was going on just by giving me a whole dump of C code for pages. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. And sometimes if they're well-named variables, it's easier to understand.
Well,
and there's other
times.
You'll see some equation written out and it's all E and I and Z and Q and these sort of abstract components. And sometimes you can look at something like that and go, this is more confusing. But if we, you know, rename some of these variables to brightness after this thing or, you know, something extremely explicit. So yeah, Blink was the fundamental development language. And then within that, a huge amount of what we ended up doing, particularly me, was developing visualizations to try and understand and see what's happened to the color as it passes through this transform. Because often it's incredibly abstract if you just put some numbers in and get some numbers out at the end, but you sort of need to see how things are getting shunted around by the different parts of the algorithm. Because it needs to look right, but it also needs to move right, for lack of a better, you know, because you can't look at every possible image and make judgments about it. Sometimes you've just got to see how are these little three-dimensional coordinates moving around as they pass through this filter, effectively.
What was the first film that you applied this to at ILM?
So the first one that we're able to use it on, and as far as I'm aware, the first sort of thing of its type was Transformers 1. My sort of primary job is being part of the color and imaging team here. But my background is in comp supervision, or comping and then comp supervision. So I'd been a comp sup on a number of animated features by that stage. And when that film came up in the building, I sort of started sticking my head up and going, wouldn't mind doing that one. You know, it could be me. You guys probably need a comp sup. I was a huge fan of the 1984 version and had a chat with people and we sort of arranged it so I would do 50% regular color and imaging stuff, that is my normal day job, and then 50% comp souping that. But that put me in an interesting position where I, being the comp soup and being the company's color and imaging guy, was able to kind of pitch in, well, this thing's not really finished yet, but I think it's going to address a bunch of production problems that we're going to have with this film.
And for those that don't know, that was based out of ILM Sydney.
Yes. So we hubbed Transformers 1 out of ILM in Sydney. We also had teams in San Francisco and Vancouver and Mumbai also doing work on it as well, but the bulk of it happened here.
Would you say that what happened when you used it in Transformers 1 was exactly what you expected, or was there either unexpected surprises or concerns that came up? Because, I mean, you know, there is this real sense of using it, baptism with fire kind of thing.
Yeah. I'd say it pretty much went how I expected it to. It was easier.
You had extensively tested it. It wasn't like you were.
Yeah, we were probably 2.5 years into the development process at that stage. We'd had a lot of eyes on it. Yeah, the transform as it exists today, we were probably 90% of the way there about a year into that process. But like everything, you know, the last 10% takes a long time. But it wasn't too bad of a pitch for me because I'd already gone through on the first Lego film a in production, I'm going to pitch this display transform and, you know, support it all the way through. I'd already done that once. So the normal questions that always come up with these things, like why do my images look different? Those are easier to defend if you know why we're making the switch. The primary reason you know, on Transformers 1 was just a far better SDR-HDR match. You know, we knew from the get-go that Transformers 1, the definitive version was going to be the HDR version.
Yeah.
You know, it had a theatrical run, but yeah, being funded by Paramount, obviously for Paramount Plus, fundamentally it's going to tie into, you know, their content collection for that. All streaming stuff is HDR first at this point. But we still live in a world where most of the creative calls as a film's getting made, get made in SDR. So stuff being consistent between the two is super important there. Yeah, we live in a post-COVID world where most people are working on remote desktop solutions of one sort or another. And so it's typically Teradici going to a Linux machine. And the reality of that is, yeah, most of the remote desktop things have no support for HDR, and Linux desktops have no support for HDR. So almost all of the key creative work is getting done in the SDR domain, but we know the final result.
A frightening amount of stuff is shown to somebody on a high quality iPad or a, you know, I mean, not finals, obviously, not the grade itself, but like that's a reality, right? Like you've got this mixed environment of how people are viewing things dealing with kind of like exactly the problems that whole idea of a mixed environment led to ACES in the first place, effectively.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in terms of creative, problems, the really obvious one in Transformers 1, and this is obvious in retrospect, but it's the kind of thing that I thought would happen when I was initially pitching it, is those hue skews we were talking about earlier. Yeah. Megatron, or D16 for the first part of the movie, for some of the film has yellow eyes, and for some of the film has red eyes when he makes his transition to Megatron. Now, with the red eyes, if you have a red eye that you then expose up with hue skews that we talked about in the original ACES 1 RT and ODT combination, as you make that red eye brighter, it becomes yellow. Now, that's a real problem if the yellow is meant to represent a fundamentally different character. And also if the rate of that transition with how quickly it goes from red to yellow behaves fundamentally differently between SDR and HDR when looking at two different versions of the same image. You know, so you've got your same underlying render data, your same underlying comp. If the eye is red in HDR and yellow in SDR, that's a huge problem.
It's a plot point, right? Like, going back to your original cartoon version, he had red eyes. It was like not at the discretion of the creative team to change.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly not something that you want to have change between display devices.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, of course, and, you know, not speaking for the whole of Lucasfilm or Disney, but how widely has it been kind of adopted, and how, therefore, successfully do you feel it's been in terms of a...
It's a little early to say yet. Like, I feel it's only really hitting the point now where it's actually out properly. Yeah, because I was supporting it, I was able to take a very in-progress version and bake out some output transforms and stick them in a show-specific config, and also do the work of supporting it elsewhere. So dealing with the DI house, making sure that they had versions for Resolve that worked properly, all of that sort of stuff meant that we were able to make that jump on Transformers far earlier than really anyone else could, practically. There were one or two other productions that we were vaguely aware of during the time, because we had some people sort of come into the meetings for a while and kind of go, okay, can we lock off on this version for our purposes? How would we do this? You know, would you guys think it's usable? But really, you know, mainstream-wise, it's only in Resolve 20, which is still in beta, that we have ACES 2 in a sort of turnkey commercial application. The fundamental transforms have been in OCIO from 2.4, but they're not turning up in a standard config until 2.4.2. So it's really only now that it's actually hitting what you would call a wide release, where it's locked off. A normal person can use it in an application. I feel like it's pretty early days yet in terms of it.
Are you done? Is this it? Is there any need for a ACES 3? That's a horrible thing to ask you when you only just released
I certainly need a rest from it, but no, there are definitely other places we could go with it. And I think there's equally work to be done on the input side as well. Yeah, the issues I was talking before with
Yeah, because you focus different, on the display referred, right? Much more on the display side.
Yeah, we were entirely focused on stuff that is from the tail end of you actually doing your work in ACES to the display. There's a whole different world of what happens with the input transforms as well.
And quite frankly, the input devices keep changing, right? Because, I mean, picking out something out the top of my head, like an Apple Vision Pro, right? Which is there's a new new Blackmagic camera that's designed for shooting. They announced at NAB. It's like, and its display is a completely different thing in that it's a high resolution, immersive mixed resolution headset. Every time that happens, there has to be a response to that. And technology just keeps moving forward.
Yeah. So, I mean, we designed the Transform in a way that it should be pretty open to new display devices coming along. You can kind of reconfigure it for new sets of primaries or new amounts of dynamic range or new midpoints fairly easily. So those are really just parameters that you can modify. Now, there are sort of more subtle questions there about your viewing surround and things like that. So we haven't really pushed the art forward there. And a lot of that was to do with most of the develop happened during COVID. Yeah, when getting people to all be in a room together with a projector and a monitor and this and that, and kind of go, okay, what are you seeing between these differences here? I don't think we've pushed that sort of stuff forward. If we want to get nerdy with the underlying mechanics of it, the big difference between the original Transforms and the new one is that we use a color appearance model as sort of the fundamental engine of the Transform. So the old one was mathematically fairly simple. You sort of came in from your working space, you made a transformation into AP1, you applied some tone curves. There's a couple of little kind of specific tweaks in there, like the red modifier and a few things like that. You would kind of slice off anything that was outside the display gamut and you would apply the display tone scale. The new Transform is much more complicated. We come in, we transform into a CAM or a color appearance model called Helwig 2022. Luke Helwig is at this point, the only doctor of color I know, but he was sort of getting his PhD during the process. And once he tied that up, he sort of joined the group and was able to help us understand this model he developed. And it's sort of an extension of CAM 02 and some of the other CAMs that have been around in the past. But we move into this space where we're not in RGB anymore. We now have a brightness component called J. We have our H, our hue component, and our M, which is our saturation component. And we're able to manipulate those independently of each other. So if you're doing stuff in RGB, if you modify something with a tone curve, it's very hard to leave the hue alone, but also modify the tone scale, or the things are sort of linked in a really awkward way, which is why you get some of those hue skews that we talked about earlier, where by rolling a color off, you actually change the color, which is really undesirable. We want to be able to manipulate the brightness or manipulate the intensity of something without modifying the hue. So the new Transforms move into this sort of abstract human visual system referred CAM space. And then we sort of look up the edge of the different gamuts that we're having to work with. So if we're compressing to a P3 display, there is a sort of three-dimensional shape that forms the container that we have to squeeze stuff into. And a Rec. 709 one has a different shape, and a Rec. 2020 one has a different shape, and dynamic range just changed that shape. So by moving into this sort of abstract space, we're able to kind of pull back towards all of these different gamut targets in a consistent way. So regardless of where the primaries are, regardless of what the dynamic range is, the things that we can keep constant stay constant. So if you do have a new display type or a weirdly skewed display type, like some VR headsets have had very strange gamuts, this means that we can retarget this transform to those with very minimal effort and have it be as consistent as it can be between the two.
I mean, it's great. It's absolutely brilliant, the contribution that you and, for that matter, ILM has made through allowing you to do all this sort of stuff. Because, again, it sounds complicated when we're talking about it to a certain extent, and yet to get back to Stu's initial, paraphrasing, it exists. And if you get the new beta of Resolve and you have it, you don't have to do complicated math. You don't have to do any programming. You just have to adopt it as a workflow. And guess what? Things are going to line up and look right. And it's ironic that you have to do all this work for someone like me to punch in things from Sony cameras and from Arri's and from Reds and everything else and have it work and not be fighting it in the grade. But we owe you thanks. So thank you.
Well, it's not just me. It's a huge number of contributors. And the people I was talking about before are very specifically about just the input side. There's other people who are working on the ACES metadata side and CLF. And it's a big project. So I can really only talk to what we did on the display side. Sure. But it's a big team and almost everyone's a volunteer. And some of them are doing that as part of their employment because, everyone in the industry realizes there are industry benefits to this sort of stuff. There are efficiencies that we all get from these projects. I mean, in ILM's case, the benefits that ILM has reaped from EXR, for instance. Yeah. Everyone in the industry has got a lot of out of that, but also ILM gets a lot out of that, because everyone uses it now, which makes everything run smoother, and that creates other efficiencies within the company. And color is the same. Years ago, prior to this sort of stuff, you would have had to have very awkward, very complicated discussions about what was going to get turned over by the plate pool house. Whereas now, with ACES, almost all shows that we have come in, I'd say the vast bulk of them turn over ACES plates directly to us, and if they don't, it's something that is very easily definable within the ACES space, and we can make very easy accommodations for it. And that just makes it so much easier for us to pipe it into our way of working because we are all ACES internally. Regardless of what some production turns up with, internally we will always be doing stuff in ACES.
And let's face it, a company like ILM also benefits from the fact that, we're talking about you and, say, Transformers 1's being in Sydney, like there are multiple offices, right? And you need to be able to move files without having to have someone in person explain them because just on time zones alone, right? You need to be able to move files around and know that even though I'm not there in London, the file you're looking at is what you're looking at and not something that I'm not sure about what you're looking at. And wait a second, that doesn't sound right, but I can't see what you're doing and I can't get on a plane.
Artists, if you have a big artist pool and multiple shows going at the same time, artists can very quickly get moved from show to show to show. So things need to work in a consistent way between those shows. As part of my job, that's what a lot of the day-to-day is making sure that illusion is kept. There's all sorts of gory details that go into making that work. But from the normal user's perspective, it should all just work in QuickBooks.
Well, again, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us, Alex. We really appreciate it, mate.
Cool. No problem. Anytime.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. As I mentioned in the intro, I really enjoyed his talk at SeaGraph, especially some of the insights he shared about the process, as it took place, at least a lot of it, during COVID lockdown. One interesting anecdote he shared was how a certain dishwashing detergent played a role in the dev process. They used Fairy brand dish detergent, which is this brilliant green color and available all around the world, to test out various cameras and situations, since it pushed the limits of the colors that can be produced digitally. Well, thankfully, we're past those days. And one more thing before we wrap up, I just want to give a big shout out to James Shen, who's been helping us edit and clean up the FX podcast for years. So big thanks, Jim, for all that you do. Well, that's it for this episode, the FX podcast. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.